with chocolate and or popcorn, and John Wick, which is well crafted, but the violence of it is getting a little tired. They're starting to repeat themselves. It's getting unimaginative. And there's going to be a fourth one. And then, of course, we're recommending J.T. Leroy, the movie, as a fascinating account of a mostly successful hoax, literary hoax, that changed a lot of people's views, made people probably more suspicious of fads. But maybe not. I don't know. Anyway, this is Film at 11. I'm D.K. Holm. I've been sitting here talking with Eric Edwards, and I'm not quite sure what's coming up next, but there is something. It's happening at 11 o'clock. So until next week, this is Film at 11. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
KBOO supporters, this is Cat Meow, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our annual spring membership drive. Canceling such an important fundraiser was not an easy choice, but thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed now through May 31st will be matched up to $20,000. We know that times are tough right now, so we're asking those of you who are able to give to donate today at kboo.fm/give. Financial support from our listeners is what allows community radio to carry out the important role we play in times like these. Give today at our website. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Thanks for your support, and thanks for tuning in.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the Children's Program for Reluctant Adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. Before we get started, I'd like to ask a favor. In more normal times, KBOO Community Radio would be in the middle of our annual spring membership drive. Unfortunately, we had to cancel the drive due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The station is closed to all but a few staff members who have valiantly kept programming going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and no one knows that better than me. I wake up every night around 3 a.m. and turn on the radio just to check. It's a small comfort, but an important one in such a strange time. For KBOO, canceling a membership drive is a big deal. About 80% of our operating budget each year comes from listeners like you, so we're hoping you'll show your support by giving online. Times are tough and money can be harder to come by than toilet paper, so don't worry if you can't spare any right now, but if you can give us a little something to keep KBOO operating like we have been for the past 52 years, yes, 52 years, please go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button in the upper left. That's what a community is all about, neighbors helping neighbors. Speaking of neighbors, which is about all we speak about on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, our guest today is Portland's Chelsea Beaker, author of the new novel Godshot from Catapult Press. Chelsea is the recipient of a Rona Jaffe Writers Foundation Award, and her fiction and essays have been published in Grantham McSweeney's, Catapult Magazine, Electric Literature, and Joyland. She's been awarded a McDowell Colony Fellowship and holds an MFA in creative writing from Portland State University. Chelsea grew up in California's Central Valley and currently lives here in Portland. Godshot is Chelsea's first novel, and what a first novel. Here's a list of just some of the accolades. It's one of Oprah Magazine's most anticipated books of 2020, Vulture's best new books for 2020, BuzzFeed's most highly anticipated books, Bustle's must-read books of 2020, Paste Magazine's most anticipated novels, Electric Literature's most anticipated debuts of 2020, and it was the Rumpest editor pick for 2020, a Library Journal's title to watch and a San Francisco Chronicle's book to look out for. Most recently, Godshot was listed as a new and noteworthy book by the New York Times. T. Kira Madden writes of Godshot, an absolute masterpiece, a truly epic journey through girlhood, divinity, and the blood that binds and divides us. Godshot is a feminist magnum opus of this or any time, terrifying, resplendent, and profoundly moving. This book will leave you changed. Chelsea, thanks for joining us today, again during this COVID-19 pandemic quarantine.
Of course. Hi, Ken. I'm so excited to talk to you today. Thanks for having me.
Now, we should mention we're talking to each other today online from our respective homes, probably as the crow flies in Portland. It's not that far. But you tweeted earlier today, I checked on Twitter, you're trying to listen to the new Fiona Apple record, which I think was released this morning, but it sounds a lot like a Kidz Bop video.
Well, in my home, Kidz Bop is always blaring through the speakers. My daughter has really been enjoying it and likes to turn it up really loud. And for anyone who doesn't know, Kidz Bop is like current hits that have been reimagined by children. So the lyrics are really clean and they kind of can lose some of the quality of the original versions of the songs. And yes, I was trying to listen to the new Fiona Apple and not having much success, so I'm gonna have to wait till tonight for bedtime.
Speaking of kids, the epigraph for your novel Godshot is a quote from Ina May Gaskin, who wrote several books on childbirth, and it goes, "Remember this, for it is as true gets, your body is not a lemon." Now, Chelsea, that was the name of one of your earlier short stories, which featured several of the same characters in the novel. You even mentioned Ina May's Guide to Childbirth in Godshot. What appeals to you about the quote and Ina May herself?
Yeah, well, when I became pregnant with my daughter in 2013, I realized suddenly that I had never seen a woman give birth, not even on a video, certainly not in person. I had never seen anyone nurse or really care for a baby or be pregnant in an intimate way. And it was really striking because I realized, well, I was doing it. I needed to know these things. And I started kind of on this path of self-education around just what birth even would be like or what it was. And I became so fascinated by the Ina May's Guide to Childbirth, which is a lot of women's stories of their birth stories, basically. And they're very different than what we see in the mainstream media, where mainstream media is birth is always kind of an emergency. You know, you're rushing to the hospital, there's lots of screaming, and then it cuts, and then the woman is holding the baby, usually. And it's usually left off the page and off the screen. And when I found Ina May, you know, she's this revolutionary midwife who kind of came onto the scene in the 70s and had the farm where women would go and have these more non-medicalized births in this setting where, you know, the women were gathered together really helping usher in the babies. And it was just like nothing I'd ever seen. So I was really enraptured by it and also inspired because Ina May was really this character who was saying to women, you know, your body is made to do this and there's nothing wrong with you. Your body's not a lemon. You know, we think of a lemon like a car that doesn't work or something. And I think sometimes women can absorb the message that their bodies aren't going to be able to do something like this and that there's something wrong with them. And she really went against that. And I just, I attached to her, and I found the stories to be really inspiring and offer such a contrast from whatever I had kind of absorbed growing up.
Now, let's talk about the story itself. Your Body is Not a Lemon, so that preceded Godshot. I saw that was published in Joyland Magazine in December 2017. It seems to be one of the seeds, if not the main one, for Godshot. It's narrated by the same character, Lacey May Heard, 14 years old, takes place near Fresno in California's Central Valley, has several of the same characters, her grandmother, her cousin. How did that story evolve into the novel?
Yeah, so I originally had written a draft of what I thought might be this book before writing that story, and it was from the mother's perspective, and it was really different. And as soon as I finished it, I knew I wanted to tap into this teenage daughter's perspective instead. And that story was kind of my first attempt at that. And that voice and sort of, it was sort of a different style for me, that story, where it was more shorter vignettes, and it was kind of a little bit more dreamy and not really grounded. But it really was the first seed into that world and into some of those characters. And then I kind of just, I stayed with it because I felt that even though I liked it as a standalone story, it just seemed like there was more there. And I knew that Lacey May had a broader story to tell.
Yeah, not only the broader story, but what struck me, and maybe it's just me alone, is her voice in the story isn't quite the same as it is in the novel. Actually, in the novel, it seems stronger and more distinctive to me. I mean, it carries the novel in a lot of ways. In a recent interview you did, a very recent interview with Lenny Zumas, you said, "All sentences for me are rooted in voice. I hear the music of a sentence and I transcribe. It's as though I'm channeling characters speaking, and I feel the buzz of their aliveness." I wondered, did it take a little time to channel Lacey May and get her voice, that buzz of her aliveness, just right?
Yeah, it did. I think, like I said, that story feels a little bit like more of a dreamier tone, a little more distant. And then my next kind of attempts were, I would say, more chatty, a little more sassy, sort of this, like a higher level of attitude, of teenage attitude and angst was going on, and very voicey. But then in the later drafts, as the narrative complicated and the situation in the town got deeper and her experience got more intense, the voice did shift into slightly a more serious tone, even though I think there is still some of the humor and there's the moments of her kind of more, I don't know, teenagery slapbacks. It's just not quite as fiery as it was in some of the earlier drafts. But I think that the voice it landed on now is one that could carry the book and handle the seriousness of the content in a better way, maybe.
Oh, it's extremely successful there, the evolution of that voice. Now, I want to talk about maybe the main theme of the book, certainly one of the central themes, and that's the mother-daughter relationship in Godshot. You wrote a recent essay for Lit Hub, and you said, "As I wrote Godshot, I thought I was writing about religious cults. I thought I was writing about phone sex operators, about drought and global warming, about birth and motherhood, California, about teenage lust, assault, incest. Of course, that's all in the book. I didn't know for years that while I was writing about those things, mainly, you emphasize in italics, I was writing about the thing I cannot escape, my own mother loss." Can you talk a little bit about that, your own personal mother loss?
Yeah, so when I grew up, you know, my mom left when I was 9, and she never came back. I think her intention was that she would come back and we would be reunited eventually, but it never happened. And so I was really haunted and still am in many ways. It's really an ongoing process, but I was really haunted by this loss where it was sort of ambiguous. You know, she was still alive. She was still existing in the world. She just wasn't in my world anymore. And I felt so much grief for that and over that loss, but I didn't know to call it grief. And I didn't know that I could be feeling grief because she wasn't dead. And so that type of loss, I knew that it was going to come out. It just was primed and ready to come out in this book. And And yes, there's all these external things happening, but at the heart of it really is, I wanted to categorize the complication of that type of loss because I don't see it a lot in literature. Maybe it's out there. I just haven't encountered it as much as I'd like, or, you know, as much as may have been helpful for me growing up. And we see that kind of where Lacey is going through that in the book.
It's kind of a loss without a finality to it, as there is, you know, if you lose someone who dies, somebody who kind of runs away or you're not as much in contact as you'd like. There's probably no guidebooks on how to deal with that.
Yeah, and it's kind of maddening because there's always the possibility of return. And so for so long in childhood, I thought, well, you never know. You know, she could come back. And that hope is really heartbreaking when it is never realized. And, you know, and then I became an adult and realized the opportunity for her to be around me growing up was gone. And then, you know, it feels like with each life stage, there's a new processing of what that grief looks like. It certainly happened again when I had my own children and, you know, continues to strike me in different ways.
Now, the LitHub essay I mentioned is actually, it's heartbreaking and beautiful. It's called Mother Loss, The Thing You Cannot Escape. It was published online about a week ago, though I think you wrote it much earlier than that. When you shared the link on Instagram, you posted this, quote, "I was trying to work on my novel, but this came out instead. In the way those important things sometimes do, without warning, unwanted, my mother was going to meet my daughter for the first time, and it never happened. I'm happy to connect with many who share the heart of my story with my mother, which is grief, grief for all the things that happened, all the things I wish could have, and gratitude for the way my love remains, her love remains, this beautiful metaphor here, a jagged rock in my pocket. Whatever story I write of her, to me, is always a love story." I was wondering, why did you choose to tell that love story, which you kind of implied here or intimated in the essay, and to explore that grief and pain you felt over your own mother loss in fiction rather than, say, in nonfiction or memoir, something like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. My impulse to explore that type of loss was always fictional. And I don't know if it was because I could come at it in a more creative way, or I could take a little bit more control over the story, where the actual story to me sometimes doesn't always give me a lot of energy to tell. It can be really draining. Writing some of these essays is a newer thing for me. When I first started writing really seriously, I would kind of sit down at the page and try to write it as more of a nonfiction story, and I just felt so blocked. I felt that there were too many things I didn't know, and I also felt like I wasn't ready to approach it in that way. But with fiction, I could come at it from all different angles. I could entertain the possibilities of different outcomes, and I could be more of the inventor of the story. While I think the heart of the story is my emotional experience, I could take more control over the external factors. And that, at this point in my life, has felt like what I needed. And I actually hope to write a memoir one day, and I think I'll know when I'm ready, but so far I haven't quite felt completely ready for that.
This is maybe a little bit of a digression, but I listened to a podcast you did, it was over a year ago, it was called 42 Minutes, and in the podcast you were in Fresno at the time. You had moved back to Fresno, at least temporarily, from Portland, and you said you were working on a narrative, nonfiction. Was that a memoir at the time, or was that something else?
Yeah, I have an idea where, you know, I want to tell some of the stories of the different women in my family in a way that, I don't know, combines them, but also isolates them and tells them in all of their sort of intricacy. And I still feel like that is a project I want to do. When we were there, it was a temporary thing, and we knew that at the outset, and I actually had this sort of romantic thought that I would be able to go back to my hometown and be there and be in the place where everything happened, so I'd be able to write this project while I was there. And I just had this idea that it would just stream out of me, and it would be so easy. And
that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. You know, it didn't. I think I underestimated a lot of the factors of that whole situation, one of which I had just had a baby who was only 3 months old when we moved. So, you know, and also actually being in my hometown was incredibly difficult. It was not that conducive to my creative process like I imagined it would be. It was really triggering to be in the places where I have so many memories of my mother, and I would be driving past, you know, these places that I remembered things happening, and I hated being there with my own kids. It was kind of a nightmare feeling that once I was feeling it, I was shocked that I didn't realize that I would feel that way ahead of time. I had really thought like, oh, it's been so long, I've processed so much, I'm such a different person, I'll have a handle on it. And it really, I didn't have a handle on it. And it wasn't, I wrote some pages, I think I wrote some good pages, and I think it's the start of something, but it didn't feel like it was the right moment to really press deeply. And then at the same time, I was editing my novel with my editor, and I had a lot of other writing things going on too. So I think I had an idea that wasn't quite right there. But I think I'll come back to it.
Was most of Godshot then written while you were living in Portland?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was just doing some of the final edits in Fresno.
Now, let's get to the story there. We've talked about Lacey May Heard, the narrator. It also involves a religious cult there. It's a town called Peaches, which is near Fresno, a fictional town. And the cult is called the Gifts of the Spirit Church, with a very imposing leader, Pastor yes. Vern. Lacey May belongs to that cult. Her mother is exiled for not following Pastor Vern's commands. I've read in previous interviews that you did that you're very interested in cults and how they got started. Was there anything like that in your experience growing up in Fresno, kind of a religious cult in town?
No, I never was a part of a cult, and there was never one that I was close to. I was really intrigued by the story of the Children of God cult and the way that they used women to attract converts. And a lot of their literature, I became really fascinated with it years ago, and I think it kind of stuck with me. I think I was always sort of interested in these extreme cases where people were doing unthinkable things. And I think the impulse is that we like to think we would never do that. We like to imagine we would never buy in to something so seemingly crazy, but yet it happens a lot. And
it's happening now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You hear about these pastors or preachers who want their congregants to attend live services. I guess they have some cognizance of COVID-19, but they figured if you get it and you die for God, it's destined, and it's kind mm-hmm. of for the greater glory.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right that it's happening right now, and it's also, I think it's happening in so many places that we're not even aware of, where in these smaller congregations there can be these really cult-like formations that start to happen that, you know, they're not in the news. They're happening. And I was fascinated by that. And also the way that in the beginning of their involvement in the cult, you know, Lacey and her mother's life gets a lot better. There is reason that it's provided a better life for them. And I wanted that to come through, where these communities can offer things and they can be really attractive. And I think that's how they pull the members in. And that's what happens in the book, and why she has such a hard time just letting it go. It's a process to let it go.
And you do a great job actually of explaining that in terms of the extreme conditions that they're living in and seeking comfort in the cult. Pastor Vern and his congregation, they follow him because there's a drought in Peaches, and he made it rain once, I think 7 years previous to the time mm-hmm. that the book takes place. And they think he was the reason, or certainly he claims responsibility, and he promises to make it rain again. They want to believe because the drought is destroying their crops. It used to be the raisin capital of the state. Now it's barren. There's a shortage of water, food, devastating wildfires. They're even getting baptized in soda. not water. It's that bad. It's such a terrifying description of the apocalypse and the reaction. There was a passage I picked out which was just so beautifully written, and I think kind of gets the point across really well. It was the beginning of chapter 13.
Yeah, I would love to. In the brash heat of November, smoke filled the valley from wildfires north and wildfires south, settling over us like a warning. I listened to the news saying the town of Paradise was burning, that people had died in their cars trying to escape. A man who had abandoned his burning car said he ran past countless people frozen behind their wheels in gridlock traffic. He knew they would all die. It sounded horrifying, but I couldn't fathom another town aside from Peaches in any clearness. All the same, the smoke from the death towns filled my chest until it ached. The only thing that would clear it was rain. God smiting them, Cherry said, shaking her head as if Peaches was better off somehow. But I saw the tremble of her hands. I knew we were thinking the same thing. We were next.
Something they don't want to think out loud. They realize that apocalypse. And you wrote some of that while there were actually wildfires. Boy, 2 years ago, we had terrible ones up here. They're in California, in British Columbia.
Yeah, so that section was kind of added in later and while I was in Fresno, because right when we had gone there, the sky was just... It was very apocalyptic. The sky was black. You know, it was so eerie. And all of the smoke, whether it's happening down south or it's happening in the north, it will end up settling in the valley because of just the atmospheric pressure and the way the valley is just this bowl where everything gets trapped in it. And so if there are fires, they're going to arrive there. And they did, and it kind of settled over us, and I felt like it was impossible to write about this region without acknowledging those particular, you know, terrifying attributes.
There's a certain context that readers are getting now with our COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, that was not something that you were thinking of. Nobody was thinking of, certainly no. While you were writing the book. Yet when reading that, I find so many parallels to our current situation. I mentioned just a few with some pastors wanting their congregants to show up and, you know, just take God's word for it that they'll be okay, or whatever happens to them, you know, it's up to God to decide. There was another context, too. I don't know if you know about the Netflix series Unorthodox?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, that has some parallels to Godshot. It's a limited series. There's only 4 episodes, and I'm only on episode 3, so I haven't finished it. But there's a young woman there, Esther, and she belongs to not necessarily a cult, but it's a Jewish Orthodox sect, the Hasidics in Brooklyn. And the guidelines are very strict, just like they are with the cult in Peaches. And like Lacey May, Esther is abandoned by her mother. She's pregnant in the book, just getting pregnant by her recent husband. And she goes off seeking her mother, who escaped to Berlin. She says at one point she's not necessarily rejecting her religion, but she feels that she's unable to live up to God's expectations, which really kind of resonated with me. Do you see that as one of the attractions of a cult or a religious sect, that doing what God expects of you or what you're told God expects of you, you get some spiritual reward for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a way that people are attracted to this idea that life has deeper meaning, that their actions mean something greater, and that if they perform in a certain way, like you said, there is a reward at the end that is not only going to happen on earth, it's going to happen in eternity. I think the idea of eternity can really be intense for people because it's obviously forever. And also in the case of Peaches, their situation is so dire. They're so desperate. They're in such a dead, ravaged place that anything to get out of that, even if it means it's going to happen in this idea of eternity, they're kind of willing to do anything for that. I think the geography of the place allows this group to really form quickly because it's so devastated and they are so desperate. Desperation makes people do intense and different things than they might normally do. And we definitely see that in the book. And that show you described sounds amazing. I definitely need to look into that.
it's not just the desperation, but they're all willing to sacrifice by not drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other passage I didn't have you read, but it was also pretty indicative of this apocalypse, where they go to the the pay and save, or the
pack and save. Yeah.
The local market, and there's no water, there's no fresh produce, there's only soda and the sugary snacks. There's one kid, Lacey May's cousin in the book, who is eating a big hunk candy bar as like the biggest treat in the world, but really it's not a whole lot of nutrition that they're getting.
Right.
So it's that kind of willingness as a group to sacrifice, and I think that seems something you've caught that also seems to me indicative of cults. I mean, the obvious one with drinking the Kool-Aid, Jim Jones's cult.
Yeah, and after you've sacrificed so much, I think it's heightened how much you want it to be true. So the further in you are, you know, the more you've lost and the more you've given away to the cult, it better be real. You know, I think that to find out that it's not would be such a loss for these people. And I think that that also keeps it going and keeps things escalating as well. Just not pride, but just the sense that if somehow everything they'd done meant nothing, the terror of that becomes too great to entertain.
You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Chelsea Beaker, author of the new novel Godshot from Catapult Press. I read that, going back to Fresno in the Central Valley, that your grandfather grew raisins in the Central Valley, and he was later Dean of Agriculture at Fresno State, and he was taking care of you with your grandmother when you were growing up, and he tried to get you interested in agriculture. I was wondering the parallels that you see between agriculture and writing, besides the kind of the obvious one of growing something from scratch.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because growing up, like you just said, he did want me to be interested in it because it was his passion. And I think he did think maybe I'd go to Fresno State and do agriculture or some idea, even though I'd really shown no interest in that. But in a way, everything that I'd absorbed growing up and has ended up coming back out in my work. And I wish that he could know that. I don't, you know, he's passed away now, but in a way I want to be like, you know, all those afternoons you were talking to me about this, it was going somewhere.
Now, the grandfather in the book, Lacey May is raised by her grandmother, Cherry. The grandfather had died. Actually, he killed himself earlier because mm-hmm. of the shame he felt, I guess, over the drought and the barren crops. So what stood out to me, and maybe I'm walking on eggshells here as a male interviewer, was the very strong feminist current in the book. There are few, if any, sympathetic male characters, maybe just that grandfather, the late grandfather in the book. And there were several really bad ones, some really bad ones like Pastor Vern. And women are the victims. Lacey May's mother, in fact, tells her very early in the book, women have a long history of suffering, and she has no antidote to that. So fortunately, Lacey May meets some women in the book who are strong and resist that suffering imposed by men, including these two phone sex women, mother and a daughter, who you call witches, but I think in the sense of divining for water, like water witching, more so.
Yeah, the town and the cult especially perceives them as witches. And then, you know, as the novel progresses, that term kind of falls away because that's not how Lacey comes to think of them. But prior to her knowing them, that's how she was told to think of them. And yeah, I think for me growing up, there was a sense that women were just kind of riding the tides of whatever situation they were in with the man in their life. That's what I saw in my early life, and definitely saw a lot of domestic abuse growing up and the power dynamics being very off. And that was just my particular lens that I was viewing the world in my really formative years. And I wanted to write a book that doesn't shy away from the truth of that, because certainly not all men are like this, but in some of these situations, they can be, and in the book they are. And of course it's heightened in the book because I wanted the evolution of Lacey to figure out a different way for herself to be really stark and really obvious, and for her to realize that this wasn't just one way to be. And of course, she finds these different portals where she can start to see the world in a different way. And one of those is definitely the phone sex women and then the birth workers. And, you know, she's given the opportunity to kind of break out of some of these patterns of, you know, alcoholism and the domestic violence and power dynamics.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the phone sex women, Daisy, who runs the operation, tells Lacey May, "You're in control here, not them." One of the few places in the world that's true, far as I know.
Yeah.
And religion itself, I think that's also clear from the book, and also the TV series I mentioned to you, Unorthodox. In a lot of fundamentalist religions, man is considered superior to women. I mean, mm-hmm. you find that in the Bible. It's certainly true with Jewish Orthodox. It's definitely true in Pastor Vern's sect. So religion is one way, I think, of controlling women, which you make very clear in the book here.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, everything in the book is so heightened. But I felt, even as an adult, kind of trying to find a church community or, you know, a younger adult, searching for different ways of being in those communities, I still found that there was such a power dynamic between men and women that was really imbalanced, and that women weren't really able to be leaders, even if you were at a church that seemed so progressive and so different, and the pastor is covered in tattoos and looks really cool, you know, still, like, his wife is not allowed to lead that church. Usually she's allowed to lead, like, the children's ministry, but beyond that, that's kind of where it's going to end for her. And I just always found that interesting, that those dynamics continue on, and certainly not in all churches. I know there's plenty of women leaders in different communities, but not ones that I was seeing, and not ones that I was seeing growing up in the church.
No, and it's generally considered kind of a reformist movement in any particular religion where they have women as spiritual leaders. There was another essay that you published recently in the Paris Review, which I loved. It's called Father's Sway Above It All. And you write about your own partner raising your kids, that he tends to get a lot of praise when he's out and about for the things that you do, and people either kind of come up to you and treat you poorly or just ignore it entirely, you know, as it's your duty and it's something you're supposed to do. And you have this line, "Anything fathers do that is not abandonment or abuse is lauded as extraordinary." So that's even today, and that's even with people who are religious or non-religious. It's just the way society is set up. The fathers kind of get a pass.
Yeah, it's funny. I really see that in our society a lot, and I think there's no more applauded version of the man than when he has a baby carrier on and is like pushing a stroller. I've just seen the looks my husband will get where it's like he's walking on water, and it's I mean, it's great. He's a wonderful father. It's a cute sight to see, but I think under that is it is so special to see, because we're not always used to seeing that. You know, generationally, I think like my grandmother can be really amazed at how involved my husband is with the kids. And I think that implies that's not normal, or that's not how it always is. And, you know, I think that's definitely still around. And in that essay, I wanted to explore that, because I think, and I was also calling myself out a little bit, because so much of my focus has always been on my mom and the ways in which I felt that our relationship was strained or difficult, or the ways in which I'd been abandoned by her. And I really focused on that. I think we are a little bit more tuned into the ways that mothers might damage us than fathers, where, like I say in the essay, with my own father, I think I was able to let a lot more slide with him just because he was present. So
yeah, it is
interesting.
He was somewhat of an abuser, at least from what I learned in the essay, of your mother when you were young, and you still have a relationship with him, however distant, and it works because you don't bring things like that up. He doesn't want to talk about it. Maybe he's forgotten about it or would rather forget about it.
Yeah, I think that we don't talk about it. There was always a sense that to do so would be to break some unspoken code between us. And obviously the essay is a total break in that. And I feel really close to my father, and I know that a lot of the love that I have for him is separate from the things that he's done, and the same with my mother, and that's fine. You know, that's sort of my own journey with that. But I feel like I'm the one left to kind of carry the truth of what happened. It feels like they've opted out, and for whatever reason, it's always felt like that load was then on me, because I couldn't really forget it and I couldn't really let it go, and it had affected me profoundly. But it seemed like they were able to kind of be like, well, you know, I don't really want to talk about that, or I don't really remember that. And that is really abusive, and I think that's really awful growing up, especially.
Was that difficult for you, Chelsea, to write about those? Did you feel maybe you were kind of breaking that kind of unwritten pact between them by describing what actually happened, even though it was, of course, your reality and their reality?
It was terrifying to publish the essay about my father. I almost didn't want to, but I knew that the better part of me saw the utility in telling a story like that. And I don't know, it's such a complicated relationship, but yeah, I felt like it was necessary to say. And a lot of my work as an adult on myself has been trying to release some of these things that I've carried, and part of that is just shining a light on it and kind of being like, look, this happened. And I think any time that I was told to not reveal something, or something was just kind of pushed to the side, and I'm sure many people experience this, you know, then shame is allowed to grow around it, and secrets breed a lot of shame. And I felt that it was important to let go of that and realize that it wasn't really my job to carry it around anymore.
Certainly your job as a writer, not just as the daughter of your father and your mother.
Yeah,
you mentioned in a previous, actually several interviews, that there were two books that were instrumental in getting you to that point. One was a Janet Fitch's novel, White Oleander, which I think came out about 20 years ago or so. And mm-hmm. then one of my favorites, Linda Barry, she wrote, it wasn't even a graphic novel, it was text and her illustrations, called Cruddy.
Yeah.
How were those books an inspiration for you and led you to get over the shame or this reluctance to talk about your past and just kind of open up to it?
Well, when I read White Oleander, it was really the first time I had seen what we were talking about before, that sort of ambiguous loss, because the narrator of that story, her mother goes to prison, and in doing so, you know, abandons her for the rest of her childhood. And she bounces around from different homes. But the way that narrator talks about the way that she loves and pines and obsesses over her mother in the wake of her absence felt exactly true to me. I was like, I've never seen it written about in that way and so beautifully. Obviously, Janet Fitch is such a beautiful writer. But it was just hitting the nail on the head of the way that I felt both so devastated by my mother, but also so in love with her and so wanting her back, so willing to forgive, while at the same time, you know, as that narrator gets older, that evolves too, and the truth seeps in and things are revealed. And that was really, it felt so close to my experience, although of course the details were different, but that was the first time I'd encountered that in literature. And then with Cruddy, the language and the voice that Linda Barry uses Roberta Robeson is like nothing I'd ever seen.
Oh, she's unique.
She is.
A unique artist.
Yeah, and reading that and reading the way in which, I love the way that book does not shy away from trauma. It does not shy away from the truth of the story, even the really ugliest moments. They're all in there. And I loved that about it. I felt really inspired to, I guess, not leave anything out. That was important to me in writing this novel.
In the introduction to our interview, I read a quote from, I think she's a friend of yours, T. Kira Madden, and you just recently did an online event with her, didn't you? Like a day or so ago? Or
I did. Yeah, we did one with Books Are Magic, which we would have done in person, but obviously couldn't.
Yeah, I actually have a question about that, about promoting your book in during the quarantine. But I just wanted to talk about one part of that quote. She was addressing the reader, of course, and she said, "This book, Godshot, will leave you changed." I was wondering, how did writing the book change you? Was it anything approaching a catharsis for your grief and your mother loss?
Yeah, definitely. I felt like I don't know. I have come to a certain ending point with telling that particular story from that perspective, that age. I felt like there was no way around writing from that age for this book. It seemed like it was this first novel that wanted to come out in me, and it was the truest story I could tell, because that experience of that age, I had been through it completely. You know, I'm an adult now, that my childhood's over. It's encapsulated in this way, and I could really get at that. And I guess now it almost feels like I'm more interested in writing from an older perspective or a different vantage point into motherhood and daughterhood. I'll probably still keep circling it, but I'm ready. I feel ready now to be doing it from a different angle.
Yeah, you mentioned in the past interviewers had asked you, you started the book, you didn't have kids, and then by the time you finished it, you had two.
Yeah.
And I think your oldest daughter is like five or so, and you have a younger child. So there was a lot you had to process to become the mother that you didn't have. I know how hard that is, and I just mentioned one example. I had a friend who had a very abusive father, and before he had kids, he was just telling me, "I'm not going to be that guy. I'm not going to be that father." And yet he has one son, and he turned out to be that guy. He doesn't talk to his son anymore. I was wondering, your struggle to get over what might be even this subconscious, not desire, but subconscious emulation of the way you were brought up, to how to overcome that and become the mother that you really wanted to be.
That question is everything. I think it really reared its head for me when my daughter was around two, and I hit this strange point. I think it was sort of triggered by, I had weaned her, and I think hormonally the shift in that may have just triggered it. But I started really becoming obsessed with the fear of spontaneously becoming my mother. I think it was also rooted in this questioning I've had my whole life, which is, how did all of those things happen? In what world did those happen? Because they, especially now as an adult, I'm with my children, thinking about the things I experienced with her seem unreal to me. They don't seem like they could have even happened, because they're so crazy and so wild and unimaginably traumatic and sad. And to get there seems like such a leap from where I am now, but it really shook me, because I thought, well, how did it happen to my mom? How did this occur? You know, did she wake up one day and it was just this way? And it was not rooted in logic, but my mind kept circling that and obsessing about it. And it took a lot of processing and a lot. It was a really long journey of separating myself, realizing that I'm an individual. I am not her, which I think I would have told you that, you know, prior to having kids. I knew that I wasn't my mother. I knew we were really different in so many ways. I was making so many different choices than she did, but having kids really threw me for a loop, because, yeah, like I said, suddenly I couldn't understand how that had happened to her, and then the fear crept in that it could just happen to me, that maybe it was just part of our connection. And yeah, it was just a lot of work kind of undoing some of those more fear-based lies that maybe I was telling myself, or that were residual. I don't know, but it's a good question. I think, yeah, every day it is important that I remind myself that I'm my own person.
Yeah, in fact, towards the end of the book, and I don't think this is giving much away, if anything, there's a social worker that talks to Lacey, and she kind of cautions her. She said, you might think you're over this and you're fine, but it's really, there's a lot of work that yeah. needs to be done over the course of your life to really overcome the abuse and the abandonment that you've experienced.
Yeah, she says, don't skimp on therapy.
Right.
Yeah, and I found that to be true. You know, I stopped drinking or using any substance of any kind when I was only 20. And it was at that point that I started on a real journey of unpacking everything that continues today. It'll be lifelong. And I think that's a beautiful thing, that there's always another layer to pull back. But when I was 20, I had never processed anything. No one had ever talked to me about the things that had happened in a real way. And once I cleared out any numbing thing that I was doing for my feelings, I was able to put the cards out on the table and begin that long process of figuring out who I really was.
So you were trying to kind of avoid the subject, maybe self-medicate, and that really didn't work. And then you got to the point where you explored it more, certainly as a, you know, individually, but also as a writer. And that's made all the difference, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Writing was really my way of recording what had happened, but also finding a meaning in what had happened. I think part of me wants there to be something meaningful from all that happened, or else I can't really find the utility in it, and that's harder to swallow. If I can imagine that maybe art could be created from it, or my experience could help another person, then my suffering has more meaning to it and is easier for me to live with. And that's just kind of like a basic way that I think that I approach the things that happened.
Oh, and I think that book will do that for a lot of readers, whether they're in the same situation as you were or Lacey Ann is or not. There's a lot they'll get from that book where you've been generously using your pain and grief to help others in terms of your art.
Thank you. Well, I hope so.
The next question is about, we kind of almost got into that with the live events at the bookstores. I mean, the book is really being lauded. And it deservedly so. And you had a whole bunch of events lined up, including reading at Powell's. I think that was scheduled for last week with Lenny Zumas in conversation with her. She was your teacher at Portland State. It must have been a lifelong dream to read at Powell's. And I think you will again. What have you been doing to kind of promote the book, but also find comfort for, you know, some of the frustration and disappointment caused by these cancellations?
Yeah, well, I've been so amazed at the way that booksellers and also just the team at Catapult has jumped in immediately to find ways and creative ways to continue to promote the book. And I'm loving these author events that are popping up on Zoom, and people are really using these platforms to try to create a sense of normalcy right now for people who have books coming out at this moment. And obviously, it's not at all what I would have imagined. And there is a lot of sadness in that. But I think I was more worried that as things started to unfold in the news and we started realizing this was really happening, and I was more worried that I'd get to a point where I was going to have an event and I would have to make the decision whether or not to cancel.
Because
for a while bookstores were like, well, it's what you're comfortable with. And I was like, please don't make me decide, because I don't know the right choice. And I know that whatever I choose will be wrong for someone. And I was more scared of like having to decide. So once everything shut down and it was just very clear that this was happening for everyone, that took a little bit of the pressure off and I could accept it in a different way. But I don't know, it's bizarre having a book coming out right now. It's bizarre like getting ready for a quote unquote event in my house with my kids like running at my feet and trying to get everyone quiet at the right time is really hard. And certainly not what I imagined. I actually, this book tour was going to be the first time I'd ever left them. And I was so fixated on gearing myself up for that, that when this happened, it felt so so ironic that now the opposite problem is true, that they'll never leave my side, for not even 1 minute a day.
I've been hearing that from a lot of parents.
Oh my gosh. I was like, well, I didn't have to stress for months about, you know, leaving after all. But it's just it's an unprecedented time, and I am really amazed at the way book people and media people are rising to the occasion and trying their best to promote books in this time. And it seems like people are reading, and I hope that that's true. And I hope we can continue to support our local bookstores and just see to the other side of this.
They're still open. I know several independent bookstores in Portland are still open for online delivery, but also a lot of them will actually deliver to your home, or they have a curbside pickup. So it's a good time to buy from those independent bookstores and keep them in business. I mean, they had a hard enough time before this. So
I know. Absolutely.
It's certainly difficult now. Oh, I had just one last question, Chelsea, and that's a book that I've read is forthcoming from Catapult. Cowboys and Angels, which is actually name-checked in Godshot, but as a totally different book, I think, is kind of a romance novel that Lacey May finds in her mother's house. Can you tell us a little bit about that book? That's a collection of stories, but with some of the same characters and setting as Godshot.
Yeah, I think of the two books as being sort of connected, sort of holding hands. It's not like a sequel at all, but there are reoccurring characters, and you might see, you know, the before life. There's a story in the collection where it's like the before life of Daisy and Florin, the phone sex workers, before they ever came to Peaches. And there's a story of Grandpa Jackie's childhood kind of mentioned. So there's different ways that it overlaps, and they definitely inhabit, in my mind at least, the same world and the same setting, and there are some places that kind of overlap in the collection. And I wrote all those stories while I was writing this book. So anytime I was taking a break from writing the novel, I was writing these stories. And plenty of the stories are not really directly connected, but they almost all take place in the Central Valley. So
is there
they feel very connected.
Is there a pub date for that, Cowboys and Angels?
Yeah. So as far as I know, it should be early 2022. The paperback of Godshot will come out next year, and then following that will be the collection.
Oh, well, I look forward to that, and hopefully we'll be joining you at Powell's for the reading.
I know. I hope so. That'd be so fun.
Well, Chelsea, thanks so much for talking with us today during a very difficult time, and I hope you get a little quiet today to listen to the new Fiona Apple record in peace.
I hope so. Thank you so much, Ken. It was my pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you, Chelsea.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show or would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to Chelsea Beaker for joining us through the magic of Skype. You can find out more about Chelsea and Godshot online at chelseabeaker.com. Just to note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, April 24th at 11 a.m. Hope to see you all again then. In the meantime, many thanks to the KABU staff, Jenna, Celeste, Arthur, Tammy, Asia, Althea, Jenka, Otto, and others, who are keeping the station running while almost everyone else at the station is keeping their distance and making radio from home. And many thanks to all of you as well for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying may there be better and more beautiful days ahead.
thought of you makes my heart sing like an April breeze on the wings of spring, and you appear in all your splendor, my one and only love.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.